about Mark?
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 3rd, 2011. First item is a public hearing on Senate Bill 389. Mr. Miller, please. Open the public hearing.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 389A establishes a uniform process to obtain confidential jury records for use as evidence in post-conviction relief proceedings, requires requests for records to be made on motion during the proceedings or in post-conviction relief petition filed no later than 90 days before post-conviction relief hearing, absent good cause to file within a shorter time, specifies the pleading requirements, permits the court to release records based on certain findings, and clarifies the standard, grants the trial court administrator and state court administrator the right to intervene, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. This bill deals with process at the post-conviction relief level. Currently in statute, we have a well-spelled-out process for obtaining confidential jury records at the trial court level. There is no equivalent statute at the post-conviction relief level. So what we're trying to do with this bill is establish a uniform and consistent process for use at the post-conviction relief level. The bill mirrors the current process in ORS 10.275. Doesn't give the petitioner any greater or lesser rights to juror records than they would have had in the original proceeding in the underlying criminal case. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? Okay, don't move. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 389. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 390.
Chairs and
Mr. Miller, yeah. Have a seat. Oh, okay.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 390 also comes from the Judicial Department, obviously, limits disclosure of records and civil commitment proceedings to parties while pending and on appeal, requires appellate court to protect identity of subjects of proceedings in its opinions, conforms disclosure to comply with federal law, authorizes the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court to determine effective date of a couple of the sections, declares an emergency is effective on passage.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Senate Bill 390 is our effort to make the civil commitment statutes for commitments for persons alleged to have mental illness or mental retardation, to make those statutes work in the upcoming e-court environment. As we moved to e-court, we felt we saw a need to do some work on these statutes so that they work better in the in that particular environment. The bill doesn't change any of the protections that are contained in current statute, but it does do some things. It clarifies that parties and attorneys have access to the case records while a case is pending and after judgment, so that they don't need to go get a court order to look at their own record. It specifies that the limitations on disclosure of this information also applies at the appellate level while the record is in possession of the appellate court. It requires the appellate courts to use naming conventions to help protect the identity of those people who have this information being considered before the court. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Olson.
Bruce, how many courts are involved with e-court right now?
Co-chairs, Representative Olson, I'm trying to remember. I know we have at least four pilot courts operating, and I believe they may be at different levels on what they're doing, but we do have some things online. Plus, at the appellate court level, they are accepting filings online as well. So they're actually quite a ways along at the appellate court level. They may be all the way along.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 390. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 391.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 391 allows tax court magistrate to hold other for-profit positions under certain conditions. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. This also comes from the Oregon Judicial Department. Magistrates are currently prohibited from any other employment for pay, which negatively impacts recruitment and retention.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. This is an issue that's come to us recently, partly because of the need to reduce full-time equivalent employment so that people, we need to be able to hire tax magistrates part-time. We also have issues with furlough, and the way the statute is written now, that even if they're a part-time magistrate, they aren't allowed to accept any type of outside employment for compensation. And as an example of how that can work, we had a magistrate who's had an opportunity to coach her daughter's gymnastics team for pay and had to refuse that avenue of employment, even though it would have no impact on her work as a tax magistrate. So this is to help us overcome some of those difficulties recruiting part-time magistrates. It would allow them to seek additional employment if the second position does not create a conflict of interest. Here are the protections that are in place if you were to go forward with this. First of all, in the statute that we're proposing to amend, 305.498, it specifically says that any outside employment cannot be inconsistent with the performance of their duties, and it cannot interfere with the performance of their duties. In addition to that, our Oregon Judicial Department personnel rules prohibit employees from engaging in the private practice of law or in any employment that would raise a conflict of interest. The Oregon Constitution, Article 3, Section 1, prohibits our employees from working for another branch of government. The Oregon Code of Judicial Conduct applies to the magistrates as well as to judges, so that they would be subject to the same conflict of interest rules as a judge, and the magistrates are also subject to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission governing conflicts of interest as well. The restrictions in statute currently go well beyond restrictions on judges, ALJs, and other OJD employees, so this is to level the playing field, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any questions in the committee?
Thank you,
Mr. Miller. Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 397. Amy Wason and Roy Pulvers, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 397A allows an action based on tort to be brought against officer, employee, or agent of a public body if the complaint alleges that the plaintiff is entitled to damages in excess of the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits. Clarifies that the total combined recovery is limited to a single occurrence, and I beg your patience to read the background. At common law, a person had the right to sue another individual in tort, but no right to sue a public entity. The Oregon Tort Claims Act provides a limited statutory right of recovery against public entities and indemnification rights for its officers, employees, and agents. Functionally, this means that when a lawsuit is brought naming individual employees of a public body, the public body is substituted as the sole defendant, and recovery against the public body is capped. In 2007, recovery against public entities was capped at $200,000. A substitution occurred as described above in the case of Clark v. OHSU, which pleaded combined damages in excess of $15 million. The Oregon Supreme Court held that the plaintiff was denied an adequate remedy as required by the Remedies Clause of the Oregon Constitution as to the individual who caused the harm, because not only was the amount of the remedy inadequate given the facts of that case, but under the OTCA, the plaintiff could only proceed against the public entity. A claim against a public body is entirely a creature of statute and may therefore be capped by the legislature, but a tort claim against an individual that was available at common law may not. When the limited recovery against the public body is not adequate, the claim against the individual cannot be entirely foreclosed by statute. The legislature responded to the court's concerns about the inadequate amount of recovery with Senate Bill 311 in 2009. Tort recovery limits were raised to $1.6 million per individual and $3.2 million per occurrence, and local government recovery limits were raised to $533,300 per individual and $1,066,700 per occurrence. Senate Bill 397A is the legislature's further response to the court's concern about the elimination of the cause of action against the individual. It allows a plaintiff to proceed against a named individual or individuals when the amount of damages alleged exceeds the cap without relieving the public body of its obligation to indemnify.
Good afternoon, chairs, members of the committee. My name is Amy Wason. I'm Vice President and General Counsel at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 397A. As summarized, 397A amends the Tort Claims Act to allow a person with a claim against a public body to bring and maintain a lawsuit against individual officers, employees, or agents of the public body where they are asserting damages in excess of the Tort Claims Act caps. This is a change from the current law. As mentioned, currently the Oregon Tort Claims Act provides that where a claim is brought against a public body and any of its employees and agents, that via the, quote, substitution provision, unquote, as it's commonly referred to, the public body is substituted as the sole defendant in such cases. With the adoption of this legislation, that substitution provision would not apply in instances where the damages asserted are in excess of the cap. Before kind of outlining the reasons for that, I wanted to mention why what this law does not do, because that is critical to public bodies in a variety of ways. It doesn't change who pays for any damages awarded in a case, notwithstanding the fact that individuals are named and that claims proceed against them. The public body remains obligated by statute to defend and indemnify its employees and agents. And in other words, any fees and damages would be the responsibility of the public body. Secondly, it doesn't change the total amount of damages that can be awarded. And this is a really important point that we wanted to call out, particularly for the committee. The total per claim limits and the total per occurrence limits set out in the statute would remain in place and be the total amount recoverable regardless of how many defendants are named and how many claims proceed against individuals. In other words, if a public body is sued and, let's say, three or four of its employees are named and claims proceed against those individuals as well, the ultimate recovery is capped by a single cap, not by a per-defendant cap. And thirdly, Senate Bill 397A does not alter the right of a party to pursue a direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court related to the constitutionality of the Tort Claims Act cap. This direct appeal right was an addition that the 2009 legislature made to the Tort Claims Act statute, and frankly, we support it, as do many parties that are facing these issues. So in light of what it doesn't do, why make this change to the law? The focus is on the apparent concerns of the Supreme Court in the Clark case. Because the substitution provision entirely eliminated a claimant's ability to pursue a claim against an individual, as distinct from just limiting their ability to pursue a claim against an individual, the court appeared to attach to have specific concerns about that provision. And Clark was, of course, a very high damages case. This statute would eliminate the substitution provision in instances where damages are in excess of the now much higher caps. You'll recall that in Clark, the court was concerned about the very low Oregon Tort Claims Act caps, which then had a $200,000 per claim and a $500,000 per occurrence limit. And the court felt those were not adequate to provide Jordan Clark with an adequate remedy. It was in response to this that the court emphasized the great disparity between the low cap amounts and the damages suffered by Jordan Clark. And in response to that decision, of course, the 2009 legislature substantially raised the caps. But in the course of its opinion, the Clark Court also expressed concern about this complete elimination of the right to sue an individual. And this passage of 397A is intended to be responsive to those concerns. One final comment before I conclude, and it is that this legislation, which will now allow the pursuit of claims naming individuals, will affect a very small number of claims against public bodies. And this is true for a number of reasons. One, given the substantially increased Tort Claims Act caps, by far the vast majority of cases are captured beneath the caps. Secondly, public bodies, and this is true of many in many litigation forums, public bodies settle the vast majority of the cases. And at least I can speak for OHSU. I can't speak for others. We typically do that in the name of the individual so that settlements are entered into in the name of the public body, resulting in no kind of on-the-record implication for an individual. And thirdly, our experience has been, and in talking with other public bodies, they are experiencing the same thing. Many times individuals are currently named in litigation against public bodies, and that occurs where there are federal series charged. Often that occurs in employment cases. We understand that that occurs in social service, in the civil rights theories that are brought in the social service settings as well. So in conclusion, given the relatively kind of small impact of this change in terms of the number of parties that will be named, individuals that will be named, and the potential, in our view, very significant benefit that we can enjoy from this, from responding to the Oregon Supreme Court's concerns about the cap, and given the vital importance of the cap in preserving resources for public bodies, we urge passage of this legislation. Roy Pulvers is with me today. I expect that many, if not all of you, know that he is a very highly regarded appellate lawyer, former counsel to the Oregon Supreme Court, and he's currently in private practice, and he can provide a little more background about the Clark decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs Krieger and Barker, members of the committee, my name is Roy Pulvers. I'm a partner in the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, and I appear on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University to testify in support of Senate Bill 397A. And thank you for the opportunity and for consideration of our written testimony as well. I won't go back over the points that Ms. Wason raised, and I want to make three points shortly and distinctly. The first is that in the vast majority of cases with damages alleged below the level of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, the law will remain exactly as it is. That is, the individual government employees, agents, officers will not be subject to suit because there's no concern under the remedy clause of the Oregon Constitution because the amount alleged is less than the tort cap limits. Second point I do want to raise is that to emphasize is the relatively small number of cases that this affects. In many instances in which you're talking about high damage cases, the individuals already are named. Those are the cases where, for example, someone has a federal Section 1983 claim based on employment discrimination or police misconduct, for example. And in those cases, federal law requires that the individual be named. So this leaves a very small slice of cases covered by this bill, cases in which the amount of damages is alleged to be above the much higher tort claims cap limits, and cases in which the individual already is not being named as a defendant. This is underscored by the fact that although the 2009 limits apply retroactively to any case cause of action arising on or after December 28th of 2007, that is, the legislature in 2009 reached back a year and a half to December of 2007 to make the higher cap limits effective to the date of the Clark decision, OHSU is not aware of any case in which a verdict or a judgment has been entered in a trial court for an amount that exceeds those new limits. So the final point I would like to make, if I may, is that the law, in returning the law to the pre-91 status, that is, the law as it existed under the Tort Claims Act before the 1991 amendments, the Legislative Assembly is furthering its own affirmative constitutional role and its underlying goal of enacting a tort claims cap that may prove most responsive overall to the constitutional concerns raised by the Oregon Supreme Court in Clark. The legislature has a manifest role to play under Article 1, Section 10, and in our view, this is a responsible and appropriate way within which to fulfill that role.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee?
committee. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 397. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 400. Council.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 400 creates an additional method to determine the date of notice of appeal is filed, specific for incarcerated persons, allows the date of filing to be the date of delivery from the incarcerated person to the person or place designated by the facility for handling outgoing mail. Under current law, there are a couple of ways a filing date may be determined for notice of appeal: the date received if it's sent via first-class mail, or the date of mailing if sent via certified mail. Senate Bill 400 permits a third way to determine the filing date, just for incarcerated folks.
Thank you. Ryan O'Connor, please.
Please go ahead and remember to state your name for the record.
Of course. Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Ryan O'Connor. I'm a senior deputy public defender at the Office of Public Defense Services. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 400 in my office. It was submitted at my office's request. Senate Bill 400 is a housekeeping bill with no opposition that we're aware of. In short, it codifies an institutional mailbox rule. That means an initiating document is deemed filed when a person who's involuntarily confined at a state or local institution submits that document to the institutional mail system. That's the point at which the person loses control over when their document is actually put in the U.S. Postal Service mail. And so, you know, it's fair to have that be the point when it's deemed filed. This just returns us to the practice of the appellate courts and practitioners for many, many years. It's also consistent with the federal rule. What happened was that there was an appellate procedural rule that had this institutional mailbox rule, and really no one sort of realized that ORS 19.260 was inconsistent with the practice of the appellate courts and the appellate procedure. The Oregon Supreme Court realized that in a 2009 decision and said, oh, whoops, wait, ORS 19.260 doesn't have this institutional mailbox rule. And so what we're doing now is just amending the statute so it's consistent with practice and the federal rule.
Thank you. Is there any questions? So essentially, we're just doing a housekeeper to get this thing straightened out.
That's correct.
The way it's being done now. Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 400. Any further business coming before the committee? Adjourned.